Hello, and a very warm welcome to the Studio Canal Presents podcast. My name is Simon Brew from Film Stories magazine, and this is a regular podcast celebrating one of the biggest and deepest film libraries in the world. Studio Canal's extensive library of over 6,000 films brings together cinema from around the globe. Modern favourites like The Kings of Summer and Blue Valentine. We've got award winners, Vera Drake and The Piano. And if I can I put in a word for Ang Lee's superb The Ice Storm, which is finally available on streaming after a very long absence. For this episode, we're going to dig into the extraordinary journey of a very special film. The triple BAFTA-winning box office hit, I Swear. What a sentence that is. Now, I'm delighted that its writer and director, Kirk Jones, is going to be joining me in a minute to tell this story of the film. But let's quickly set things up with a clip from I Swear.
Are you okay?
Yeah, I think I just had to get it out in the car earlier, you know? Like, when it all builds up.
Yeah. You're pretty good at suppressing your tics then.
Sometimes it just, like, depends on how the day's going, you know?
The hospital send people to me every now and again, you know. But, to be honest, I'm not really sure how much I help them.
I thought that you were, like, some sort of specialist doing my dad's work.
No, I'm a specialist, but I've read a bit.
Yeah. You're the first person I've met with Tourette's.
Does it help?
Not at all, you wanker. No, I'd say so.
A very big welcome then to the writer and director of I Swear, Mr. Kirk Jones, the Studio Canal Presents podcast. Hello, Kirk Jones. How are you?
I'm very good. How are you?
I'm not too bad, thank you very much. I've made fewer award-winning films than you, though, just in terms of instant distinction. I mean, you've done so many interviews with regards to this film. Let's just do the standard opening question. If you can kind of just set up for us what I Swear is about, and then we'll go nerdy.
Okay. Before we go nerdy, I Swear is a true story about a man called John Davidson, who grew up in the Borders in Scotland. And when he was about 14, he started to develop Tourette's syndrome. And I first became aware of John in 1989. He was in a documentary that the BBC produced, which was called John's Not Mad. And I think from that very first documentary, I was completely and totally engaged with him, his story, with the tragedy, with the humor, with the challenges that he faced every day living with Tourette's. And about 3.5 years ago, I was looking for my next project. I watched the documentaries again. I Googled John. I contacted him, went to see him, and asked if he would be interested in me making a feature film of his life story. And thankfully, he said yes.
And so just to set you up as well, you are a writer and director with films such as Waking Ned, Nanny McPhee, Everybody's Fine, What to Expect When You're Expecting My Big Fat Greek Wedding Too. But chief amongst those, 26 years ago, you were at the BAFTA ceremony as the most promising newcomer in 2000. I just wonder, we're recording this after you've been to another BAFTA ceremony. I wonder if you can kind of like reflect on the version of you that was at the BAFTAs 26 years ago with the one that was there now.
Well, I feel like I need to start by making an apology to BAFTA because having nominated me as most promising newcomer, it's taken 26 years to return to find a nomination. I'm slightly embarrassed by it. Well, I'm very embarrassed by that. But having said that, I'm absolutely thrilled to have returned and to have waited for a film like I Swear and to have made the film with such an incredible group of people. But no, I am embarrassed about that. And actually, Simon, no one else really spotted that. But well done. Well done for the research. Yeah.
Okay. Well, as you know, I like to drag you down to my level a little bit. So we'll boost you up from this point onward. But still, I mean, it's quite a journey that you've been on. And you say it's taken you a while to get to this. I'm kind of curious how people choose projects and how you feel you can reach up to the next ledge And I just wonder, had this come to you like 15 years ago, would you have had the skill set? Would you have had the brain space to develop it in the way you did?
I don't think so. I really don't think so. So in many ways, I'm glad I waited this long, because I think this is probably the best version of the story that I could tell. And I think I needed to wait until now. I think over the years, you know, I've made some films which have been very, very commercially successful. I've made some which have been not so commercially successful. But I think I've learned a lot about tone. I've learned a lot about balance of humor and emotion in other films, which is kind of a theme in my films, really. If you go back to Waking Ned, Everybody's Fine, you know, they all contain humor, natural kind of humor, but they all contain a lot of emotion as well. And of course, John Davidson's story required me and the cast and the crew to tell this story with the most delicate touch to combine the levels of humor and emotion that make up on a daily basis the condition that we know as Tourette's syndrome.
Interesting. So, I mean, there is a version of this film that would have been a lot more, I'm loath to say deathly serious, because you do treat the subject matter seriously, but it sounds to me like the version of you now is far more comfortable with knowing how much humour to put into a story. Would that be a fair reflection?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the one question that almost everyone is asking me on a daily basis is, how did you manage the tone and the combination of the humour and emotion? And the only answer I've really got is instinct, but that instinct has been formed over, I mean, how many years have I been making films? I think Waking Ned was, well, I probably started writing it in 96, and I think we shot it in 97. So pretty much 30 years I've been working in film. And yeah, I agree. I don't think I could have made this even 10 years ago, I don't think.
It's interesting as well. A lot of the conversations that have been had with you throughout the journey of this film have been about directing the film, but it's the screenwriting that really fascinates me as well. I don't think that's been talked about an awful lot, that you were the person who stared at a blank page once upon a time.
Yeah.
I just wonder, how instinctively did that come to you? How many drafts were you going through? How quickly did you find it, what you wanted on the page?
Well, I'd never made a biopic before. And I actually found it much easier than normal, because if I write a film like, you know, Waking Ned Divine, for example, I have to create everything. I have to create the world, the subplots, the characters, the dialogue, the character traits, absolutely everything. I sat down with John Davidson, in contrast, and just listened, you know, for days, just said, talk, John. You know, what about this? What happened when you were at school? What happened when you got your MBE? What was it like when you left home and you found Dottie? And so I just went through everything with him, and I recorded it on my phone. And then I would go away and I'd spend weeks just carefully going through those recordings and those stories. And I was really keen to put every single story that John told me into the first draft of the script, because I didn't want to miss anything and I didn't want to make any judgments early on, because there might have been scenes, and there were scenes which were significant, but you might have overlooked because you thought, oh, well, that's not very interesting. I'll just cut that. I won't put that in the script.
Yeah.
So I have a document somewhere which is about 195 pages long, and it's probably closer to a transcript of all the interviews and all the stories.
Yeah.
And then I started to bring them down. You know, there's small things like, as an example, John told me that when he first went to Dottie's, he started to relax more, because in his own house, he'd been told, you know, don't do this, don't do that. You have to try and stop. And it was a nightmare after a number of years. You know, you can imagine his mental health. And Dottie says when she came to him, he was very thin, he was pale, he never smiled. That's hard to think of John Davidson now. It was weeks before he smiled, and he didn't understand or didn't engage in their humor. He was nervous. And there was a very simple story where he said Murray, who is Dottie's son, and him, one day they painted Murray's bedroom, and then John ticked and he hit his face with paint, and then they messed around. And basically I wanted to put it in because it just showed two teenagers just having a laugh, you know, and getting up to mischief. And John had never had that before. So I had that document. I had everything in there. And I found it easier starting with the truth and starting with the stories that John had told me than I had done before with, you know, just fiction.
And who is Dottie for those unfamiliar with the story? Can you introduce us to her?
Yeah, so essentially John grew up with his real mum and his real dad in a house where, you know, no one's fault, but it was quite strict and they struggled, understandably, to come to terms with John's Tourette's. And he was being told, you know, you've got to be able to stop that. Don't say this, don't say that. And then through a friend of his, a friend called Murray, he went to Murray's house and was invited in to have something to eat. And he met Dottie. And Dottie had worked in mental health for many years. And she looked at this kid and just thought, is something not right? I mean, she obviously could see the Tourette's, but she just felt that there was a lot more going on. And she basically said to him, look, you know, if you want to stay here and have a break, you know, it's up to you. And he ended up moving in for what was supposed to be a 1 week period and ended up staying, as you do, for like, you know, 10 years. And Dottie tried to help him find a voice and to feel more confident about talking about his Tourette's and about educating people and about talking about his feelings and how other people could help him. So John says, without any doubt, that Dottie saved his life. He isn't sure that he would have carried on feeling every single day that he was the cause of the problem.
Superheroes sometimes don't wear capes, right?
Mm.
Come in, love. I'm Dottie.
You're going to die of cancer.
Ha ha!
Sorry.
Right. Well, it's nice to meet you too.
I mean, I promise nerdy, and so I want to go into your storage lockup, Kirk Jones, if that's okay.
Yeah.
Because we talked right at the start, months before this film came out, and you mentioned finding notebooks that you'd written in like the late 80s, 1990s in a storage lockup. Tell me about those notebooks and what else was in them.
For obvious reasons, I can't tell you all of my ideas that I've had over the last 30 years, but, you know, many of them don't look very good. And that's the whole point. That's why you write them down, because you think if I go back to them and 6 months time and I still think they're good, and then I go back in a year's time and I still think it's good, the chances are it's a good idea and I should give it some attention. But of course, when you look at something that you wrote 20 years ago or 30 years ago, you think, no, that's not a good idea. I'm glad I didn't spend 2 years making that one, you know.
Yeah.
But I think it's really important to write stuff down, and I always say to, you know, young people and filmmakers and things, just write everything down, you know, because it's all, you know, of use, or it could be of use at some point. And it's just nice to look back and remember all the thoughts that you had and stuff in case there's any kind of gems hidden away there.
So you transcribe these ideas, and as you say, presumably there's lots of ideas in there for something you've written down in early 1990, I think you made the first note of it, to still spark. Yeah. Was there anything else in that file that sparked, or was it just like this one shining like a beacon that this was the story you felt you had to tell?
Well, I guess it depends on my mood at the time. You know, when I write those ideas down, I don't necessarily know that I'm going to be looking at them 30 years in the future.
Yeah.
And I think what it was that it fitted my mood when I looked 3 years ago.
Yeah.
It fitted the mood of a project that I felt that I wanted to make. So I'd been making films in America, pretty disillusioned, to be honest, with the whole system. And I'm not the only British director to have said that. It's a very, very different world over there. It's much more politically charged when you make a film, and it's much more about business than it is about film. So I'd had a few experiences over there, and I, you know, again, it was post-COVID, and we all know that some people just strolled through COVID. Some people, you know, experienced tragedy.
Yeah.
But for many people, it was an opportunity to sort of look and reflect on, you know, where they were, where they live, what they were doing, what their job was like. You know, were they going to work forever, or were they going to, you know, retire at some point and relax, or whatever. So I think for myself, it was about looking at my career and where I'd started and where I was. And I really desperately felt the need to get back to a small, low-budget British film that I could make on my own terms instead of feeling like I was just part of a, you know, a filmmaking machine. So, you know, there would have been other ideas in those books, but they weren't attractive to me 3 years ago because it didn't fit that kind of small British film mold.
Yeah. So 3 years ago, 2023, were you conscious at that point, because you've told the story in interviews fairly recently, were you conscious at that point that the way to get this made would basically be to use the funds from your own house? Was that, did you go into it with that at the back of your mind that if you needed to get it off the ground, that would be the way to do it?
No, I didn't. Not at that point. So when you say 2023, it was actually at the very end of 2022. It was like beginning of December when I first went to see John. And then things worked out and then I wrote the script. And then I sent it to Piers Tempest, who I'd met before and I liked a lot, but we hadn't worked together.
And he's the producer of the film, to be clear. Yeah,
three producers. There's myself, there's Piers Tempest and Georgia Bailiff. And he said, look, this feels like the kind of film that needs to be made for as low a budget as possible so that we keep creative control. Because he'd spoken to me already about, you know, my disillusionment with the States and things. And so that was the principle. And I thought, yeah, that sounds right. Let's keep it small as possible and as cheap as possible, basically. And then around about that time, my wife and I had already sold our house. We had moved to Bristol, to the West Country, which is something we'd always wanted to do.
Yeah.
But we hadn't bought another house because we just thought, let's just see. Let's see what the area's like, see what we want to do. So we had our life savings just sitting there ready to go. And then Piers came back to me and told me what the figure was. And, you know, to any of us, it wasn't a small figure. But with regards to making a feature film, it was tiny.
Yeah.
So then I was aware of the savings that we had, which was everything that I had after a 30-year career. Yeah. Then at that time, we had one single meeting. It was very informal, but the response to the script was what I had feared it might be. And that was A, we love it. B, we want to get involved. C, if the language and the level of the language stays as it is, then we wouldn't be interested. And we said, okay, well, thanks very much, and walked away. And I knew then that either this would be one of those projects that took 10 years to finance, with money that would allow me to keep creative control, which we hear about all the time, films that take that long, or we needed to find an alternative source of finance.
Yeah.
And it was very hard for me to not entertain the idea of breaking the golden rule, and it is a golden rule, and it's known In fact, when I showed the film to Emma Thompson, who I know, and I said, Emma, we've been really bad. We've broken the golden rule. And she knows what that is. Everyone in the industry knows what that is. You never, ever put your own money into a film. It's literally like putting it on a horse and
Danny DeVito headlined a film called Other People's Money precisely, I think, for this kind of reason.
Yeah. So if I say to people, look, I've made this film and I've broken the golden rule, everyone says, you didn't, did you? You didn't put your own money in. So I went to the bank and they said, look, because you've actually got, for the first time in my life, I actually had some money in the bank.
Yeah.
They said, because you have those savings and we could do this and we could do that, we give you a loan, la, 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 and we could do it. And I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe it. So the bank were extraordinary. And then I went to Cindy, my wife, and I waited for, you know, when I thought she was in a good mood, and I just pitched the idea and I said, look, this is how much it's going to cost. I spoke to the bank. We could do X, Y, and Z. And she literally took about 3 seconds, because she is pretty extraordinary and amazing and deserves a huge amount of credit for this film getting made. And she said, look, if you feel strongly about it, if you feel passionately about it, then let's do it. And that was it. And we never discussed it again. I had some form filling to do with the bank. But other than that, it wasn't like, you know, have we made the right decision? How much is everything costing? That sounds too expensive. Why are we doing this? There was none of that. It was just like we made the film in a professional way with amazing producers, cast and crew. And what then happened, and, you know, this is no surprise, is that when that, you know, I didn't make a big announcement when we started making the film, but people started to hear that that was the situation. And I just have crew coming up and shaking my hand and saying, well done, well yeah. done. And they knew that what that meant was that they had their creative freedom under my umbrella, and they didn't have some huge empire above that saying, you know, you've got to change the script, we don't like this, it's too sad, there's too much swearing and stuff. So it had an incredible knock-on effect.
In terms of footprint for the British film industry as well, one story that I think has been lost a little bit over the last couple of months is the number of people on the crew who you promoted up a level for the first time.
Yeah.
And you're leaving the legacy of the film, obviously, but also you're helping people up one rung on the ladder. Are there one or two? I think your DP hadn't shot a feature film before.
No.
I mean, presumably when you're doing that, you're getting, I would imagine, a really enthusiastic crew that they're closer to the controls for the first time.
First of all, everyone related to and wanted to serve John Davidson's story. That was like level one. Number two, it does have a practical benefit, because if people are being offered the opportunity, and I did this, by the way, when I was younger, you know, I worked for free, or you say, listen, I'm not going to ask the world, because this is the break that I've been waiting for.
Yeah.
So that's another thing. But most importantly is the level of enthusiasm. You look in the eyes of everyone who's on that crew, and you know that they know that this is their opportunity to shine.
Yeah.
And yes, James Blunt. I must have looked at maybe about 40 DPs, or, you know, their showreels and things, and I think I got it down to about 12 people that I wanted to speak to.
Yeah.
And the enthusiasm, the focus, the excitement from those who had not shot a film before was really, really hard to ignore. And of that smaller group, I just went with James. And that's a risk, you know, that's totally a risk. It would have been easier to go with someone that I'd worked with in the past that was much more experienced. But then, you know, you kind of feel it's like anything else in the world, you feel like people just settle in and they do what they'll always do. And so it was a real kind of punk approach, but a very professional one. You know, our production designer, she'd only just finished her first film, Sabrina. She was amazing. But then the whole crew was balanced. You know, I've been doing it for 30 years, so I'm overseeing everyone.
Yeah.
Next to me is my sound recordist, Simon Hayes, who won an Oscar for Les Miserables and had just come off of Wicked 1 and 2. So Simon is as good as and as experienced as anyone you could hope to have on your crew in the industry. And, you know, the sound and DP work closely together. Simon doesn't come in thinking, you know, James, this is his first film, I'm going to give him a hard time. He comes in thinking, this is James's first film, I'll do everything I can to support him from a sound point of view. And they work really well together. You know, it's a very important relationship, the sound and DP. So it was a beautiful mix. It was a joy. It was an absolute joy. It was the best experience I've ever had on a film set.
Oh, it's incredible. It's incredible. I mean, can you pinpoint in the journey that you've been on, the kind of little, appreciating films are a culmination of thousands of decisions. Are there like two or three that you felt really turned it into what it became? Were there key pinpoint moments? I'm talking to Piers Tempest, sounds like one of them. The casting of Robert Aramayo, clearly another one. But are there one or two that have just kind of been lost in the noise a little bit?
I mean, absolutely, Robert Aramayo was a key turning point. And again, not wanting to go on about the way the film was financed, I would never, ever have been able to have cast him if we had gone to traditional forms of finance.
Yeah.
And I can tell you that because that's how things have been for 30 years with me. You know, you find someone who's exciting, who's new, who you know is best for the part, and you present them to the studio or the financier, and they go, great. But, you know, they don't know who he is in America, and he hasn't been cast in the lead before. So if you can just go back and look at that list that we sent to you 6 weeks ago, and, you know, just let's go back and focus on you know, realistic options. So those are the sorts of conversations that you have. But I was able to cast whoever I wanted because of the finance. So and that goes through to Peter Mullen, and it goes through to Shirley Henderson and Maxine Peake. And so the casting of the film, which coincidentally has just won a BAFTA, you know, fighting off all of those huge,
yeah,
multi-million dollar films, you know, we picked up that award, and those people, those cast, those actors were there because they were the very best choices for those roles. So that was a key one. And of course, Rob is part of that story. You know, we've talked about it, but being able to finance the film, absolutely unique in my experience, and I think probably in most directors' experience. You know, I think you'd speak to anyone who's you know, been working in film. I think that's incredibly rare. So that level of control, and I've always wanted to do that. I didn't set out with on this project and say, like, this is an experiment. But if I had done, it would have gone something like, this is an experiment. I have spent 30 years listening to other people, having to work within the constraints of making films. I just want to see, you know, I'm just interested. What happens if there's no one there, an experienced, talented, creative team of 60 people are left alone? What do you get back? Do you get back a crazy art house movie that doesn't make sense and lasts for 4 hours, which is what many financiers would suggest? It's like, you know, leave the filmmakers alone and it will be a disaster. Yeah. Or do you get a tight, commercial, entertaining, emotional British film that is, I think, fourth highest in the UK box office for British films last year, that has 6 BAFTA nominations, walks away with 3, picked up lots of awards elsewhere. You know, which will you get? And I know that I was pretty confident that I could deliver with an incredible group of people something that really worked and the audiences really want to see. Because I think where we are now is a situation where people just keep making the same things over and over again, because 8 years ago, a film like that managed to make some money, so everyone wants to make a film like that.
But even so, 9-10 months ago, I saw a cut of this film, and I remember getting in touch with you at that point and saying, this will win BAFTAs, and you looked shell-shocked. You know, you it was almost like it wasn't on your radar at all. And I'm kind of curious what that gap was like. You finish making the film, you know it's tested well, but your house is, I mean, your money's on the line. You've taken arguably the biggest gamble you've taken in your career. And there must be this vacuum of a few months where you just don't know whether it's going to work or not. And I'm just curious what it's like being the human being who's like signed one of the checks in the midst of that bit.
What you're really talking about is the period in the cutting room, because you come off of the shoot, and I came off of every single day feeling like we had something really special. Yeah. And actually, a story that I haven't told most people, I think we'd been going about 4, 5, 6 days, and it was the end of the day, and we said, right, that's it. Thanks, everyone. See you tomorrow. And everyone's like packing up, and I'm chatting with someone. And Simon Hayes, sound recordist, again, multi-nominated BAFTA and Oscar, and Oscar-winning and BAFTA-winning sound recordist, stopped everyone. And he said, sorry, can I just say something? And everyone said, go on, Simon. He said, is it just me? He said, or is everyone else feeling it as well? And we all like looked around and he said, no, I'm serious. Is it just me? He said, I think we've got something really, really, really special. He said, is no one else feeling this? And I felt it. Of course I felt it. I felt it from the, you know, first time I saw Rob perform, you know, in front of the camera. But you can't talk about those things. Well, certainly as the director and the writer, and most of the crew don't want to talk about them, those instincts or those feelings, because they know how hard it is to actually see that gut feeling, which is probably true and probably right, come to fruition in a finished film that's been edited and promoted and distributed and people giving it a chance. And, you know, so you know that it's still very, very, very early on. But I remember that. And I joked with Simon the other day when we picked up the BAFTAs, I said, you were the first to call it. And I told it, and he remembers, and the crew that were there left behind remember. So when you say I was shell-shocked, I think deep down, I felt like this film could do anything because I'd seen the reaction from people and I knew how I felt about it. But what you always also know is that it's not always a fair world. It's not always a fair playing field.
Well, quite. And I've got shelves of DVDs behind me of like discovered gems that have taken 30 years for people to appreciate that they're any good. And like you've got money on the line now. And I'm not suggesting like you're stuck in a bungalow at the back of Pontins or anything like that, although I suspect it's quite glamorous. But there is a here and now that this has to work for you to some degree now to kind of for the gamble you've taken. That's the bit that I'm just, as you say, it's not fair. How many great films have we seen that took so long to find an audience?
Yeah. I mean, you know, Robert Aramayo should not have picked up the BAFTA the other night just because he deserved it, just because of his performance. It just doesn't fit into the real world, you know. Leonardo should have picked it up. Timothy should have picked it up.
And they're great performances as well. But
They all are. But that's all. You sit there and they say, and the winner is, and you just know that in the real world, outside of your head and outside of your gut feeling and outside of all the things that people have told you and all the, you know, audience responses and things, you just know that in the real world, they're going to say, Timothy, that's the word.
Yeah.
And then they say Robert Aramayo. And so you just know with a very small film that everything is always going to be against you. So that's why you don't allow yourself to get too carried away. So that's why when you said to me, you know, 9 months ago, I think this is going to win BAFTAs, I didn't say, yeah, me too, Simon, you know, great, isn't it? See you in February at the awards. But you hope, your gut feeling is that it's got legs and it's got appeal, you know, to other people. So just because you don't, I've learned over the years. I mean, I remember getting a tip off before the Golden Globes, the day before the Golden Globes, when Waking Ned Divine had released in America. And it was huge. It did, you know, I traveled all America. Everyone loved it. And I got a tip off and they said, look, there's been a leak. Just wanted to tell you, you've got a nomination for best film at the Golden Globes. Where are you going to be tomorrow? Stand by. This is amazing. Of course, I hardly slept that night. Couldn't believe it. Started working on a speech. Yeah. You know, oh my God, what, you know, what if I was there? And it wasn't true. It wasn't true. It was fake. It was something online that someone had made up. So I've learned to just like, you know, it, what will be. And if people like it, they like it. If they don't like it, fine. But I know that I came home every night thinking, I don't think today could have gone any better. And at no point, if people are interested, at no point did I regret putting everything on the line. I still haven't seen a penny, by the way. Again, if people, because I think people assume that, you know, everything's paid back now. I haven't seen a penny, but no regrets at all at this stage.
Yeah.
And actually thrilled and grateful that we had an opportunity to finance a film.
I mean, it sounds like one of the experiences of your life, the way you're talking about it now.
I want that. This won't happen again. I mean, I turned 60. Actually, I turned 61 last October. So it's not. It's absolutely, it's not. But what it has done for me is given me real clarity and focus moving forward.
Yeah.
So you can imagine there's been interest since this film came out. And I'm just batting everything away. And I found a project which I feel really excited by. And actually, I'm supposed to be starting next week. And it's something that I would write and I would direct and I would be a producer on. And that is the level of the control that I hope will continue to serve me well for the rest of my career. That's all I'm interested in now. I don't want to go off to America and sign up and be a director for hire. I want to create, shoot, write, post-produce films in the UK. That's what I want to do.
So it's the I Swear cinematic universe now is what I'm taking away from that. That's it'd be a terrific box set at the end of it all. Can I take you to one tiny moment? Because I'd imagine you've had lots of tiny moments like this. And I sat in a room with you where the film was screened with members of the Tourette's community invited along. And there was a young woman in the crowd. And I've done loads of Q&As over the years, but I've never had one like this, where someone was so choked by what they were seeing on screen, so surprised, so taken aback that they could barely get their question out. I imagine you can remember her that night as well.
I still talk to her. We're connected on social media, yesterday. She sent me a note yesterday, yeah.
Tell me about the small aftermaths, for want of a better word. There's like a community that's building around the film. Are you sensing that? Are you getting that?
Yeah, I mean, people have said quite early on that this is becoming a movement, and I just thought, whatever, that's just their way of describing, the reaction things. But I'm due to go to Parliament in probably about 6 weeks' time. I've been asked if I will screen the film in Parliament and present it to MPs. So that will be fun to do that. I'm getting notes and letters from young people, not only people who have Tourette's, but people who have all ranges of neurodiverse conditions, autism, OCD, ADHD. And for anyone who knows anything about that world and about neurodiverse conditions, they'll already know that most people don't just have one single thing. So I've never heard anyone say, I only have Tourette's. People will say, I have Tourette's. And also, I have a level of autism and I have this, that, and the other. So it seems to be appealing to a whole group of people who live on a daily basis with conditions, some of which are very obvious and public, like John's. He shouts out and he swears. And other people, it's more about, very high anxiety or levels of OCD that no one really knows, but they have to touch things and they have to do things and they have to follow a pattern. And it's debilitating and it stops them living a regular life. And they're all sending me notes and messages and wishing the film well. Everyone's sending me stories asking if I would consider making a film about their story. And so I've never made a film like this before. And in a way, it's kind of really why we should all be making films, is to try and make some change or to educate on a certain level.
And to round things off roughly where we started, nominee for Best Newcomer, Kirk Jones.
Yes.
The BAFTAs, where you're sat there and you're hearing names like Lauren Evans for Best Casting read out and Robert Aramayo. Mm. Tell me how you felt in that moment. The camera cut to you a little bit in the coverage as well. And you look quite emotional, quite overwhelmed by it.
Again, small film, everyone put so much into it. So the fact that we were there with six nominations was pretty amazing. John was in attendance, Rob was there, Rob's dad and mum were there, and I've got to know them.
Yeah.
And I know how, thrilled they are for him. And I know how surprised Rob was to be there and how thrilled he was. Cindy was there, my wife, next to me. So it was like, we did it. We put everything on the line and look where we ended up. It was a wonderful, wonderful night. But of course, you sit there thinking, maybe nothing will happen tonight. Maybe it's just one of those things. We sit in the seat for 3 hours, getting hotter and hotter and thirstier and thirstier, and nothing will happen. And then, so the first one was Lauren Evans for casting. And as soon as you get one, what it does really is it means that people have seen the film.
Yeah.
They have voted.
Yeah.
And they voted in sufficient numbers for you to win that category. And those three things are very, very difficult to achieve. Even making sure that everyone's seen the film is hard, because there's so many films that BAFTA members have to watch. And then you think, okay, so we know that the process worked and we know that we have now won an award. And then we got to Rob's Rising Star.
Yeah.
And that's a wonderful award, by the way, but it's unpredictable because it's up to the voting public, and who knows. And also these days, sometimes you worry that people are influenced in those public polls by you know, pop stars who have got 30 million followers saying, you've got to do this, you've got to do that. Anyway, that was great. And Rob won. And then as we, the, then it, we started getting, no, okay, so then my two, no, my one came up. No, my two, sorry. So Best British Film.
I was going to say, you were nominated for two, yeah.
Yeah, my Best British Film came and went, which is fine. You know, you just wish that Hamnet, for example, wouldn't have been made this year, because then I think, so you think silly things like that. And then we got to screenplay, which I never expected to win. When you look at, you know, up against Paul Thomas Anderson and you know, Marty Supreme and all those guys, I didn't expect it, but of course I had to have a speech. And I thought about what I would say if I went up, because who knows on the night. So, in many ways, that's a feeling of relief, because it's like, I really do not want to stand in front of all those people looking at me. I think someone said it was being broadcast to 120 million people or something like that.
No pressure. No pressure.
I don't enjoy those moments. I do get very nervous and anxious. So I thought, okay, phew, I don't have to do it. And then we were left with Rob, and we were left with Best Actor. And when... I can't even remember who announced the award now, but when I heard the awards and the winner is Robert Aramayo, and I saw Rob's face, he sort of fell back into the seat.
Yeah.
And I said something to him. His partner jumped on him. His dad's coming down like that. And I said to Rob's dad afterwards, I said, Mike, I was worried about you. He said, what were you worried about? I said, you look like you were about to pop. And he said, No. He said it was amazing. He said, but I did have a heart attack in 2018. I said, yeah. He said, no, I did. He said, I was in an ambulance. I had a heart attack and I died. He said, Rob was there. And I'm like, are you kidding? He said, no. And I thought, oh my God. I look at this guy who's like absolutely pumped up. And then he tells me he had a heart attack in 2018. I couldn't believe it. I said, Mike, you've just got to calm down a bit. No, he says, you've got to live your life, haven't you?
I mean, it's not a bad moral to the story, is it?
Yeah.
Kirk Jones, what an extraordinary journey, an extraordinary story. And I can't thank you enough for joining us to tell us this tale.
Thank you.
Huge congratulations on a film that I just think will live on. And I think you're getting a sense of that as well, that I think some stories, once you're done, everybody moves on. I think this one will be with you for the rest of your career. I wish you the very best. I look forward to the I Swear Cinematic Universe. Kirk Jones, thank you very much.
Yeah, you too. I'll give you a front row seat.
I'm looking forward to it.
I Swear is now available on DVD and Blu-ray. We've just got time for a quick roundup of the latest goings-on in the world of Studio Canal. Filming is now underway on Martin Scorsese's first feature since 2023's Killers of the Flower Moon. This time, he's shooting What Happens at Night, based on the novel of the same name by Peter Cameron, that's been adapted to the screen by Patrick Marber. And what a cast! Jennifer Lawrence, Leonardo DiCaprio, Patricia Clarkson and Jared Harris are all amongst the names to have been announced so far, with more apparently to come. We'll have more news on it later in the year. Finally, Mike Leigh is now wrapping up filming on his latest top secret film. As with 2024's Hard Truths, Studio Canal will be releasing this one in cinemas, although also, as with every other Mike Leigh film, it's all a bit under wraps until the man himself is ready to tell more. I do know that Marion Bailey, Paul Jessen, Kate O'Flynn and Alice Bailey-Johnson are in the cast. I look forward to bringing you further details. And that brings to an end this very special instalment of the Studio Canal Presents podcast, and I'll be back soon with the next episode. Until the next time, to get all the news on Studio Canal films as it happens, and to find out more about the Apple TV and Prime Video channels, you can visit www.studiocanal.co.uk or follow Studio Canal at Studio Canal UK on X, Instagram and TikTok. Until the next time. Ta-ta for now.